Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Another episode of Bootstrap Web. Brian, been a little while. Nice to see you.
Yeah, nice to see you too. I'm back home. You and I hung out about 2 weeks ago out in Portland. That was a lot of fun.
That was funny.
That was. We had a good dinner. I just got back from the family trip out west. It was really a good time, good break, and we made our way through Portland. We had a good night out there with you, me, John Ewalt, and Ruben Gomez. Yeah.
Yep. That was funny. We went to my favorite restaurant. As soon as I got home and told my wife about the night, she was like, "You're such a loser. You go to the same restaurant every time. You can't even drag your friends there."
That was some good Thai food. I enjoyed it.
It was awesome. And we went through two table turns, right? We sat there, a whole thing.
We closed the restaurant. They were totally like, you know, we were that group who like, they started blasting the music to like get us to get the hell out of there at the end.
I go there every single week. So maybe they were just being nice. But anyway, we had a great time. We talked biz. We talked normal.
I met the Carhook team too before we went out.
Yeah. That's right, because we were celebrating one of the employees' 1 year anniversary, which is cool. That's starting to happen now. We've only had two of those. So we were out having a drink when you met up, and then we went out to dinner. That was cool. That was a good time. More of that. All right, Brian. So it's the middle of the summer. The 4th of July just happened. Our dogs are recovering from fireworks trauma. Where are we, man? Where are we? What's happening in the universe?
This year, 2018, was one of the years where one of the first times I was like, I'm not going to make any big annual goals this year. No goals, no revenue goals, no like, oh, I'm going to launch this and that product by the end of the year. I just found that in the last few years, 12 months is too far out to make any sort of prediction or even a plan. This year for me has been all about, okay, 2 or 3 month roadmaps and then take it as you go along, you know? It just feels like less pressure for me. I don't need the pressure of like, oh, you have to execute according to the plan that you laid out 12 months ago. Now it's like I could take things as they come, what's happening on the ground, and make a plan for the next 90 days from there. So I think the last 6 months has been pretty good. Like Audience Ops has been pretty stable and flat. But then, especially now that I had this 10-day trip with the family, like really like separate myself mindset-wise, like take a step back, travel, have some time on an airplane and at beaches and whatnot. And now I'm like starting to really think about big picture, like how do I finish out the next 6 months, this year? And just really starting to think about, you know, making progress and changing my focus and mindset in a lot of different ways and like diving into all sorts of new projects. I'm really excited.
We're going through something similar here in terms of projects where it does seem to feel like every roughly 2 years or so, it feels like, okay, you need to keep going. What's next, right? For us, it was a different product, but it was inside the company, right? For you, it was expanding to different types of services. And yeah, I don't like the annual thing. I'm basically allergic to anything that says this is what you should do. Like all of that just seems fake and wrong and misguided and overgeneralized. You should do this and you should check up every 6 months and you should have this thing set up and all that advice. It just weighs on you, makes you feel guilty.
I think our circle of friends and other bootstrappers and like everybody comes out with the annual goals blog post or the annual recap blog post around December and January. And I fell into that the last few years too. And there's nothing wrong with setting goals and being really focused on making progress. I'm all about that. But I definitely found that like the last few Decembers and Januaries, I would just get depressed because I would just look back at what I put down and everything changed. And either I didn't achieve what I set out to do, or I totally changed my plan. And that it makes me second guess what I'm doing. Right now, one of my big primary focuses is learning to code. I could talk more about that in a minute. But like one of the concepts that I learned in learning to code is don't put in unfinished code for features that you might build later just to lay the groundwork now. That just adds bloated code and too many areas where you might introduce bugs, right? So it's the same exact thing with basically building your business. It's like, don't make too many plans that are just unfinished now. You got to kind of, at least I'm learning that now, that you got to work on what's on your plate right now.
Yeah, yeah. And things end up taking longer than you want them to. And it's good to have some pressure on yourself, but the fake type doesn't seem very helpful. I like deadlines. Hey, deadlines are healthy. That's how I get anything done.
I also think that at this stage in the game, like, you know, you and me and most of the people we know, like we don't have any problem with execution or motivation. you know, like,
yeah, that's not the issue.
When you're early on in your bootstrapping career or business career, it's about like staying accountable and staying focused and not having, you know, shiny object syndrome and, or just motivation and issues. Like for me, that's never been a problem. So I'm afraid to say that I'm a little bit better at focusing, but I do a lot of stuff. So we'll see.
My frustration these days is just speed. It's just frustrating how slow things go. I don't know. I just always feel a little bit behind and things just linger.
Is that new for you given the size of Carthook, the team and everything? Like, because like in the early days, you can move a lot faster than you can now, or what is that?
You know, I think I've just been frustrated by speed the entire time because I'm not the tech side. So I try to have sympathy and I try to understand, and then I try to add, you know, 50% to the estimate, and it just still is really difficult to get things out on time. And it's not just tech, it's the non-tech side also. So we've been working on these two projects that have been driving me a little bit nuts on the speed. First, we've been working on a new editor. The way our product is right now, it has three types of pages: a checkout page, upsell page, and a thank you page. And then people build funnels with those pages. So we want to also start offering landing pages. That's our next product, our next piece of the suite. Landing pages require more editing, more functionality. And
more customization.
Right. So we figured, okay, the right way to do it is not to launch a landing page app with a different editor. Let's improve our current editor and then use that new editor as the foundation of the landing page app. I think it's been 6 months. Now, editors are hard, right? There's no bullshit. Editors are hard. Making things drag and drop, making things not glitchy, not buggy, render properly, mobile, like all this. There's a whole bunch of stuff. It's very complicated. But man.
Yeah, 6 months. Like six months to 6 months. You know?
6 months. And the real issue, at least for me in the frustration piece, is that we decide, okay, we want to execute on something like a new editor. And then there's a whole bunch of strategy and like all these moves that happen after the editor's launched.
Yeah. The editor itself isn't launching the landing pages feature.
That's right.
It's just enabling you to do the landing pages feature. Right?
Yes. And so when the editor is delayed.
Like the editor itself is not the marketable thing. Right? Like it's a benefit to your current users, but it's not like something that you could do a whole campaign around.
Right. Now we're going to do a big campaign around it because, hey, it's a big enough feature to make a campaign around. But the thing that changes the math of the business is a new app in the Shopify app store that gives us an entry point into the app store where we don't really have all this other, like in my head, I have the strategy laid out, but I can't execute on it because the pieces aren't in place yet. So it feels like, okay, we're not pushing the editor out 6 months. We're pushing the strategy out 6 months plus the 3 months it takes to do the next thing. That's been hard. And then we've been working on our new website.
The other thing that complicates at your stage now is that you're building this suite rather than a single product. It's almost like every new thing that you build has to be ported across the suite, and that adds time.
I see it as one product. I try to get the product and tech teams to see it that same way. It's an ongoing conversation because they have to treat it like multiple apps. In my head, we're building one thing, right? We're building a tool that allows people more control over the front end of their store. Now, it ends up being these parts, and that's the part where I get the, well, that's your problem. Like you figured out how to do that. That's your job to figure out how to do that, you guys, right? And I'm supposed to say this is what the market wants. I get frustrated when I have to go back in and say, well, now I'll give my input on how it should be. Whereas I want it to just be, here's the strategy, you guys go implement. But it's not that simple.
How about just marketing what you have now while, like, obviously that's probably what you've been doing the last 6 months, but like I remember a time when you guys couldn't handle the load of all the signups, and now it's like you guys are ready to scale at least the checkout product, right? Like,
yes. So that has been ongoing. It is a little frustrating to know what's coming out and not be able to use it. But we've talked about this before, about like if not physically then at least mentally siloing off marketing and sales from product and tech, because marketing has that real proof of, hey, people are currently paying, therefore I don't need anything else in order to keep promoting.
That frustration that you just hit on, I feel that all the time right now with Ops Calendar. It's almost like the product that will never die in a way. I talked about the tech wall that I hit earlier in the year and how now I'm kind of starting to learn to code. And I'm not going to get into too much detail, but I'm starting to put together kind of a game plan roadmap for like the next iteration of what Ops Calendar will become. It'll be some sort of new product version two, kind of, I'll talk more about it later. But the thing that happens, I still get trial signups for Ops Calendar. Like, it's out there. It has customers. It has all of our clients on Audience Ops. And like, sometimes I get feature requests from customers. They're like, oh, it'd be great if it could do this and that. And that's awesome. Like, that is awesome. Like, the people are using it and people are finding it organically. A very, very small percentage are actually converting to paid customers, but there are a few who are like actively, they need this sort of thing. But the tech had basically hit a wall and I can't build new features on what we have there. Like, it, I've come to the conclusion that it has to be rebuilt. Whatever I invest in building and hiring developers to build is going to need to get rebuilt anyway. And bootstrapping, that just does not make financial sense.
You can't make progress. You can't satisfy people and what they want. That's the most frustrating thing. You're like, I figured out what people want. I built something that people want and I just can't keep going and giving them what they want.
Yeah. It's not like game-changing features, although I'm sure having these things would increase conversions, no doubt about that. But it's like nice to have. Like the request today was like, oh, it'd be great if like the notifications can be labeled this way, or like if the email notifications could work, or if I could integrate it with my Slack team, or like just stuff like that. Like, I'm like, yeah, that would be great. Like, it's in our roadmap for like next year, you know?
I agree. Yes. Not now.
Yeah. So I talked about how I've been learning to code this year. Right now, that is my full-time job. Like, I am deep in it. And
how's that going?
It's going. Like, I'm actually making a lot of progress. I'm really excited about it. I'm having a lot of fun with it. I'm very frustrated that I'm like a toddler at this point.
So you can walk around, you're just bumping into everything.
Yeah. Like, I'm not a newborn. I was a newborn a few months ago. Now I'm a toddler. Now it's like, okay, I understand the tools. It's like, hey, this is what the world looks like. Now let me walk around and touch things and put things in my mouth and break things and
hurt myself.
Let's see what happens if I put this metal object into the electrical outlet. And, you know, like, I'm learning all the like the framework and the tools. So, and now I'm actually starting to build like practice apps, learn as I go, just extremely, extremely slow. Every little thing I have to Google and look at Stack Overflow and YouTube videos and go back through tutorial videos just to make every inch of progress. But that's how I'm learning, you know, and I think that's the best way to learn. I had to go through a long period of going through courses just to figure out like, okay, how do I use a terminal? How do I set up a development environment? How does the framework work with like MVC concepts and all this stuff? So like, I talked a little bit about Rails versus Laravel.
Yeah, where are you now?
I've gone back to Rails basically. So I started out just dipping into Ruby a little bit, and then I made the switch to Laravel. I blame Ian Landsman for sending me down that rabbit hole, by the way, Ian, if you're listening. So I actually went through Laracast for a little while, and I started learning, you know, the Laravel framework, and that was actually very helpful. I spent probably a month or two on that. It was helpful to get my head around the concept of like, you know, model view controller frameworks and basic object-oriented programming. And like, there are too many little syntax, PHP syntax stuff and programming things that I just get so hung up on. And I'm not a programmer by trade. And what I started to figure out was that like Laravel, at least in my view, is really great, really efficient if you were a PHP programmer to begin with. If you've had that skill before, then Laravel makes everything faster and easier and better. Then I switched back to Rails. I went through the 1 month Rails course, which was really helpful. A lot slower pace and a lot more basic beginner.
1 month Rails? That's the name of the course? 1 month
Rails?
Yeah,
the site is onemonth.com. They've got a couple different courses and one is called 1 month Rails. they structured it as 1 month. I burned through it in like a week, basically. I did a lot of the videos like on the plane coming home from the West Coast and everything. And so I found that Rails is just easier for me to learn and pick up, and easier and faster to actually get an app up and running and building with like scaffolds and generating code. And I'm still super basic, just learning like what the framework, how all the things work and how to build stuff. But it just makes more sense to me. Like coming from a front-end designer background, like Rails just seems easier to pick up. And I know it's, you know, Rails these days, 2018, is not like the hottest, newest tech craze anymore, but I'm not going for that. I'm going for the tried and true thing that is easy to learn, that has a ton of resources and community out there. And that seems to be Rails. So what I did this week, now that I've gone through a couple of course videos and tutorials, I have a list of a couple of like really simple app ideas that I want to design, build, and actually launch as real apps. Probably just like free to use. Just let's see if I can build something like this to get through that process. So the first one is basically like a to-do list app. It's kind of like, you know, the hello world of learning how to build an application. So, you know, I mocked up like a really basic to-do app, and today that's my project. I'm building that.
That's where everything starts, the simple to-do app.
Yeah. Generate to-dos, generate tasks, due dates, and like completed, not completed. You know. Yeah. You know, I'm working my way around all the popular like Ruby gems that you need to piece together an application and all this kind of stuff. So I'm going to give a shout out. Well, first of all, to John Ewalt, our mutual friend who runs Roaster Tools. He and I have been talking a lot over the last couple of months because he too has been going through this process of learning Rails. And
just a couple of 40-year-olds learning how to code. No big deal.
Yeah, exactly. he recommended a book that I started reading by Justin Weiss called Practicing Rails. And I just picked that up. It's like an ebook. What I like about this book is that it's kind of like a book about how to learn Rails. It's not... There's some code snippets in it, but it's not about code. It's about like how to learn and go fast and test and try stuff out. So I'm going through that. And I've been talking to a few people in my orbits here, kind of looking for a mentor, like a coach at this point. Now that I'm starting to build simple projects, I'd like to put them in front of a Rails coach and so that they can tell me all the thousands of things that I'm doing wrong. But yeah, that's my number one priority right now is be able to build and launch ideas.
Brian's going to take the Ruby world by storm. Yeah. We actually had this very interesting conversation internally. We're doing a bunch of branding stuff. We're doing that thing you're supposed to do at the beginning of a company, like 4 years later. We're thinking about like branding, positioning, colors, feel, all that stuff. We talked a lot about development languages.
So Carthook is developing its own language.
Oh, God, no. But it is something where, like, I don't know the difference. Technically, the difference between Ruby and PHP, I have no idea, but I have a sense of them from their brand, their community, the influencers involved with them, the colors, all this stuff. So it's like you could see how powerful that is when you're truly ignorant of what Ruby on Rails actually means. But just the fact that it's on Rails like tells you something.
Yeah. You know what? I totally get that. I totally see that too. You're right. There is a difference in... like brand and community. And I don't know if this is true or not, but it seems to me that Rails just seems more business oriented to me.
Like business oriented. What PHP is like creativity?
No, I mean like...
See, it's even hard to explain, right? But you know there's something there.
People who are invested in being Rails developers are invested in building SaaS businesses. I tend to know more Rails developers who are entrepreneurs, like who own their own products rather than being a PHP contract developer or a PHP developer employee. I mean, we certainly know founders who use Laravel, but like friends of mine who are Rails developers who run bootstrapped software businesses, they tend to use Rails because it's a more efficient way of getting something long. At least that's my impression of it. It's like
that, as an outsider, that's the same impression.
It's got like the DHH and Basecamp mentality behind it. It just seems efficient, you know?
We talked about Stripe and why everyone on the internet is copying Stripe's design and how you can't really copy Stripe's experience. Like the experience with Stripe is very strange as a user. You love them because you can take them for granted. It's a very strange thing. Like, here, we built this amazing thing for you. You don't even have to care about us. But just working with it is this weird pleasure that you then take advantage of, and then you get take for granted. And then the second you rub up against a competitor, you're like, Jesus, this is so horrible. That's why I love Stripe. It's this very strange brand. The Stripe thing is interesting because I had a call with people at Stripe in which they were asking me for feedback on a new product. This is like a terrible humble brag, and I'm sorry, but it's still interesting. Yeah. So because we're partners with Stripe. And so they're doing this new partner platform or program or portal, whatever you want to call it. That was a lot of P's. And they were asking me for feedback, and I got to sit and give Stripe feedback on like their UX, which was so ridiculous.
Right.
but
that's awesome.
It was great. But they were asking me like to explain like how I think about Stripe. It was this very, very strange experience of like, well,
yeah, I mean, I could see how valuable that must be, like to get like a semi-outsider. I mean, you're a partner, but like you're not in Stripe company. They want to get feedback from people who are how people view it and use it. Stripe to me has gotten like just the user interface, man, like it got so much more complicated than it used to be. Yeah. I kind of get why like they added the ability to do products and everything, but like I've screwed things up for customers because of their interface.
It's moving around. It used to be a utility that was there for you when you wanted it. And now it's more of a product and it has these individual features and it's starting to, you know, it's almost like that it's starting to listen to what people want instead of being like, no, we're good.
Yeah.
Here's the API. Yeah. So it also helped demystify where it's not that they're just the most talented, smartest people ever. It's that they put a lot of work into it and they talk to random people and partners.
And they're so huge. They must be covering so much ground in terms of commerce on the internet that they're starting to become, as much as I love Stripe, like they're becoming kind of bloated, or at least the interface feels kind of bloated because they're covering for all these different use cases.
Yeah. Yeah. We interact with Stripe mostly from an internal tool that we call Hook. And that is where our support and success people cancel accounts and refund people and change plans. And so we use Stripe's API more than we use Stripe's interface, which is helpful. And again, it's back to that utility where you're like, you just couldn't really do that with authorize.net or NMI or PayPal or whatever else. Yep.
So this is totally random. You know, getting back to our let's quarterback other people's businesses. What did you think of Nathan Barry's switch to from ConvertKit to Seva?
All right, I'm trying to like.
All right, did you follow much of like the announcement and everything?
I did, and my biggest impression off the bat was, damn, you got a lot of people talking about it. So that's a win. In terms of the rollout, an in-person event, along with a name change and a video and a landing page and people talking about it, it was like...
Seems well executed.
That's how you get the word out. So that was the impression that I got, much more so than like, what do I care about, you know, the name and the colors and all that stuff. I didn't think about that nearly as much as I looked at the process of, okay, if you're getting people in person, that's where you make a big announcement because that's where people talk and that's where you have this amplifying effect in person and online and Twitter and so on.
Yeah, I mean, you're totally right. And you could tell by the way that they rolled it out that he and the team have been planning this for a long time.
Yes, I wouldn't be surprised if it's a year.
Yeah.
It gets in motion a really long time.
I heard him on Pat Flynn's podcast, kind of talking through it, and I think he said it was like at least a year, like something. Just...
Yeah. Now the personal preference on the name, I don't even know. I don't even care. I don't think that's important. Is it Seva.com? Because if it is, that's a really nice short domain.
I believe it is. Yeah.
Yeah, which is great. I think it abstracts the connection between the product and the benefit, which I think is intentional. Right. It's not about conversions. It's going bigger. It's like, I think what all these companies like Drip, they end up wanting to be the hub of your business.
I think that's where it's going. At least my take on it is like ConvertKit is kind of more tactical in a way. Like you're talking about like tactics and conversions. And whereas, yeah, the name, I think it's pretty clear. Like they just want to go and build other software products, like to build more of a suite kind of thing. And they're changing their name to support that direction. And we have no knowledge of this, by the way. We're just totally speculating. It seems to me like they're like they've taken ConvertKit, they've built automations and everything, and I'm sure they're going to continue to develop that, but they've built the core feature set of an email marketing automation tool. They're probably looking to other things to add on to that.
And I think that is, it seems that it's inevitable where that goes, right? That goes to the front end on landing pages. I don't think it goes all the way toward website builder type stuff, because that's a different business entirely, but they do have the resources to do it.
I wouldn't see them going that route. Maybe landing pages. Sure. I think they have some landing pages features in ConvertKit.
Right. But they do. And modals and exit intent and that sort of thing.
I could see them going more in the commerce side, because they're like about helping creators earn a living. I think what they have now is like tight integrations with all the Shopify's and the Gumroads and everyone and Stripe. But I could see them eventually going down into some sort of commerce play to help you sell eBooks, to help you sell courses.
This is the same thing that Lead Pages found themselves in. They said, oh, we have 40,000 customers, and every single one of them sends the money, the transaction off to a different service. As we have figured out in Carthook, processing revenue gives you power. If I were ConvertKit, that's the direction I would go. You basically have all these creators and they're sending transaction revenue off to somewhere else, whether it's Gumroad or Teachable or whatever. And keeping that home would provide a lot more power.
It's always been interesting to watch the story and the trajectory of what Nathan's been doing with ConvertKit, because like we would never advise anyone starting anything, especially if you're bootstrapping, to go for some big broad brand name and to develop a whole suite that will cover so much ground. When you get to the level of where ConvertKit is at, like, and the marketing position of where it's at, that's where you start to unlock that sort of freedom to think a lot bigger, like to progress from, okay, it's a tool for bloggers to it's an email marketing automation tool to, okay, now it's a much broader brand. But it's interesting to me to think about like, okay, at every level of like, whether you're looking at like a revenue graph or whatever.
I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah. But like at every level, you start to unlock new possibilities that just you would not be in the cards when you're pre, you know.
And if you tried to pursue them, it wouldn't work out for you nearly as well. Yeah, Jason Lemkin talks about these different phases of basically 0 to 1 million ARR. And then 1 to 10 is like a completely different thing, right? And now ConvertKit is over 10
They're
million
over
ARR.
That, yeah.
Right. So to get from 10 to like 50 all of a sudden is a completely different thing again. And it makes sense. And
it's like what got you here won't get you there. Kind
of yes. The interesting thing that I'm looking at right now, ConvertKit's bare metrics will make you cry. it'll turn you into mush. So to see like the preposterous trajectory, and then all of a sudden they hit $1 million in MRR, and then the past 2 months, flat. The first time I've ever seen that graph flat. For like 2 months in a row. Usually they're adding 25K in MRR every month. It would be interesting to see if they're hitting a churn wall of like, you know, you keep growing, but if you don't grow it at an accelerated rate, at some point you even out. And it'll be interesting to see if this Seva rebrand brings them up to the next level, or if they struggle for a few months. It's struggle.
Right. it is interesting. That one's been fun to watch. It was just cool to see that come up like as a total like, wait, what happened there? What, they're changing their name? Like that just comes out of nowhere, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of the few software type wars that we are actually close to. The Drip, Lead Pages, ConvertKit, like that stuff is actually happening pretty close to our orbit, as opposed to other things like, you know, Salesforce and SAP and like whatever. It has nothing to do with us. Yeah, so I can close things out a little by just talking about something that we're working on, a new campaign, and then I can kind of report back over the next like month or two as that starts to go. So as we're ready to release this new website, the goal is to have it out by the end of July. So we have a floor. we have like a set number of trials that we can pretty much expect if we do nothing. Like, you know, we get X number of trials every month. Lately, what we've been into is spikes. Like, how do we take that floor and what are we going to do this month? These one or two campaigns or emails or events or something that's going to spike it up. Almost like Ankur from Teachable, right? That they would like set a floor and then they would try to add on to it. So we've been doing that. What we've started to talk about as we focus on this new website, right? A new website is like a completely new set of numbers. And you really hope that conversions go up. You don't actually know. The site that you look at right now when you're bored by and you're like, oh my God, I can't believe the site's been up this way for 18 months. That actually might work well. You just don't really know compared to what you're doing now. So we're looking at this new site. We're saying, okay, how do we establish a new floor? Not like, how do we get a spike this month? How do we take the existing floor and 2x it so that our new floor has like a new set of math of like, you know, X amount of MRR signs up and this amount stays and this amount churns? How do we like really change that math? So one of the campaigns that we're doing, we've kind of come to the conclusion that we need more education to go along with the product. And we're doing what we can on onboarding, and our success team is doing one-on-one, reaching out in demos and, you know, after people sign up and showing them how to do it and whatever else.
When you say education, it's education to existing users or trial users who, like, on how to use, get the most out of the product, or education around like, hey, this is a business opportunity or this is a problem that you should be thinking about. And by the way, there's a product for that.
The main goal is for people who sign up for trial to get them to understand the basics, how to set up.
Are you trying to improve trial to paid or more people in the top of the funnel?
Trial to paid.
Got it.
Now, you know, as you start to think through this, you inevitably think to yourself, okay, how do we also use this content to increase the top of the funnel? But the primary goal is trial to paid. We've been working with Sid, who's our marketing coach, on like, okay, how do we do this the right way? So coincidentally, I got an email this week from someone. And basically the email was like, hey, Jordan, I'm responsible for bringing over like this list of really important clients of ours. And is there anything else that I can do like to help promote Carthook? I'm like, who are you? Right. If you're actually responsible for bringing these customers, we need to know each other. I need to like send you flowers, because he rattled off like a roster of our most important clients. So I just get him on the phone and I'm like, dude, what is happening? How are you sending over these clients? You know, let's talk here. We need to be closer. It needs to be, what can we do for you? Not what you can do. What can you do for us? So as we're talking,
who is he? Is he like a consultant or?
He's a consultant down in San Diego, and he's focused a lot on Klaviyo, which is the email marketing software that a lot of higher end Shopify stores use. He gets people coming to him for help with Klaviyo, and then he gains their trust, and they look to him as a consultant for other stuff. And when it comes to post-purchase upsells, he basically tells them, I've tried all of them and Carthook's the best one, especially for higher end. Like, yes, it's more expensive, but I haven't seen any of the other options on the market be able to do $5 million in a month for one merchant, right? Like, it's a different thing to do $5,000 a month and to do $250,000 a month in a day. It's just, that's just kind of, we built it for that. And that's why our price is a certain way and so on. So basically what I told this guy was, all right, we're talking about education. What do I need to do? What do I need to pay you basically to build us a course? Build us a course. We will use it internally in our onboarding. And first, we'll pay you for it because it's a good amount of time investment. We'll help you come up with the curriculum and you do the execution. And then your name will kind of get out in front of every single Carthook customer. So it'll be good for you and your agency also.
Is he like a course guy? Like, is he a teacher kind of person?
In talking with him, I was like, this guy's just good at communication. I asked him about if he's done it before. And he's like, yeah, I've done some webinars and I've done this thing. And, you know, so he's done some of it, which is important to me to know that he can do it. But you don't want someone too high profile where then they overshadow your brand. So it's kind of just right. It would help elevate him. It would help us, all this stuff.
Why outsource it? What is the unique value that he can bring to an internal course that somebody on your team can't?
Just execution capacity. It just makes it a lot more likely that it'll get done in the short term if we outsource it. Now, I would love to hire someone full-time as an educator,
This is more of a one-time project.
Look, I think we're going to need more and more and more education, and we need weekly webinars and all this other stuff. So I do want an educator, and maybe that's what it turns into. Maybe some, like, you know, get them into the company thing, but finding the right person as an educator, that might take that's going to take months. And this is something we want to give a try now. And so at least for this project, it seems like it would make sense to outsource. So now over the next few months, what we're going to do is not just create the course, but also start using it through our marketing. So there's something about courses that are free that makes you not value them, right? We kind of know that. I've done it.
I've been thinking a lot about this too lately.
Yeah. So what our plan is to basically build this course, put a price tag on it, call it $500.
And then you get it for free with car hosting.
Exactly yeah. Right. So then when we do weekly webinars, we can basically say, if you're in trial or you're thinking about being in trial, if you sign up from this webinar, you get this $500 course for free. And it will help upgrade people who are in trial to paid immediately. It'll help get people in the door from not trial to trial. So, and then we're starting to think about, okay, how do we use this in our onboarding? How do we use this in our marketing? How do we use this? All these different pieces.
I'm going to talk more about this in future months, but something that I have really on my mind right now is, as I'm thinking ahead to building this next software product, after I slog through kind of learning to code, and I'm starting to think now, like maybe in parallel while I'm playing around with code, start to build out some key marketing assets for this next iteration of the product. And it's going to be some sort of big educational asset like that. I'm trying to think through how to structure that. And I think it's going to be like its own domain name, its own brand, maybe like a daily email newsletter kind of thing, or like with like series of tiny tips over a long period of time, or some sort of course. I mean, the productized course also kind of plays into this as well, but just a dedicated product in and of itself that's just educational, but the purpose is like this education leads into or shows off the product, to the software product, you know. And if I could start getting that together over the next couple of months, so that into next year, as the product comes together, we have that thing that's been building up email addresses.
Yep. So yeah, it's how do you use the content education based on your situation. So I looked at Teachable and I looked at Thinkific, which are competitors with one another. And if you go to, let's say you just go to Teachable's website, if you scroll down, you'll see join this week's webinar. If you join that webinar, they will show off the product, give you value that day. Like, here's how to come up with your first course class or lesson. And then at the end of it, you'll get an offer for a course if you buy Teachable. They're kind of doing it right, and they have its own domain. It's very, very interesting to...
But I'm definitely finding, or at least in my view, I'm starting to think about like that top of funnel entry point, lead magnet, to build a big broad base of an audience to then sell a product to. These days, like the typical webinar or the typical, like even like an email course doesn't totally cut. Like having an email course or a webinar is good once people are already on your site and already on your blog. How can they start to learn more? And those are really good to offer to existing email subscribers to help nurture them. But that top of funnel thing that you can go out and push to the market and say like, hey, like scream from the rooftops, this is a really great resource that if you've never heard of us before, this is worth your time.
Right. It's valuable as is.
Yeah. Like it's gotta be bigger. It's gotta be like its own product, you know?
Yes. So that's exactly where my head started. And then talking through it with Sid, it helped us just understand, well, on its own, it's not going to work as well as without the webinar. And the webinar on its own won't work as well as along with the course. Because the webinar is your opportunity to show off the product and get people value. And then the course and the value of the course, the fact that it is in fact a paid course, you're not like bullshitting. If you wanted it right now, you got to go buy it. That gives people not only the impetus to do it now, the other thing that happens with it is now they're like, they're even more invested. Like they pay for the software, they have the course, like they're just in a better place to succeed with the product. As we see so many trials come in and they're just like, what is this? I thought it was just upsells. I didn't realize it was a checkout. So they're just like hearing about it on Facebook. They're coming in. And if I look back over the past year, there are hundreds of thousands of dollars in MRR floating out there of people who wanted it, tried it, and it didn't really do enough or they didn't get far enough. All right, man.
Good stuff, buddy. Well, have a good weekend and we'll catch up one of these next few weeks.
I don't know if this was a good episode, but I had a great time.
Hey, good stuff as always. I enjoy it. I don't know why people still listen. But.
Thank you. Anyone still listening? Yep. Thanks. All right, man. Have a great weekend.
All right. Have a good one. Later.